Hi, and welcome to another episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we chat with people who are doing cool things to advance security. I'm your host, Jed Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs, and my co-host is the fabulous Todd Beardsley. Hello, Todd. How you doing?
Hello, Jen. I'm doing great.
In this week's episode, we're going to be joined by our good friend Rob Graham, and we'll be chatting with him in a little bit. First, we're going to do the rapid rundown, and Todd is going to educate me on some stuff that's happening in security right now. So what's happening with you, Todd?
Guten Tag. I am coming at you from Nuremberg, Germany, where I am at ITSA right now. But I'm going to be talking about U.S. politics instead at this rapid rundown. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right, my Fraulein. This week was announced the Election Administration and Voting Survey for 2020 by the Election Assistance Commission. And this is a survey that the Election Assistance Commission is putting together to send out to election officials to figure out all kinds of stuff, ranging from registration to voter experience. And the reason why I bring it up today, security and technology. And there is an open comment period right now. It opened this week, and it'll be going through, I believe, December 21st. So if you're a security mucky muck and care about things like election security, you should comment on this thing. We have a link to that in the show notes. And I bring this up in particular because there's not one but two requests for comments going on. The Election Assistance Commission thing is one. The Election Industry SIG, which is a tiny little subgroup in the IT ISAC, is also looking for comments on the election industry's, they're calling it like an open coordinated vulnerability disclosure program, which is really big news, actually. It is, I think, the first time that all of the major election equipment vendors have acknowledged that, yes, there are bugs. Yes, they don't know about all of them. And yes, they know you know about them. And so they are looking to build this thing, and they're very much looking for a request for comments. So if you have any background or interest in vulnerability disclosure on voting machines, all the way up through like voting management systems, give that a look. That was announced. It was announced a little while ago, but time is running out for that one. The comments close on October 21st, so get on it. It's a great opportunity.
That sounds like a really big deal.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity for people who are, you know, big into election security and voting machine security to no longer just have to vent about it on Twitter. Like, they can help shape, like, I know, right? They can actually do a thing.
That sounds counterproductive, though.
No. We're big fans of coordinated vulnerability disclosure, and it warms my heart. I was in the room when it was announced at the CISA summit just like 3 or 4 weeks ago. I was looking for an opportunity to bring it up here because I do want people to pay attention to this thing. Do you look for, you know, provide your comments, your experience, your input, especially if you're somebody who has been around the block a couple of times when it comes to vulnerability disclosure. You know, this is kind of new for this industry, but they seem sincere about it, right? Like, and it's everybody. It's ESNS, it's Hart InterCivic, Dominion, Unisys, I think, is in there too. So like between these three or four companies, like they cover like 90% of like the election hardware in use in the US. So I think it's a great next step for them. I don't think they've solved security, but they do acknowledge that, you know, CBD is a thing.
I mean, like, let's be honest, none of us have solved security.
No.
I'm not alone in that regard. But like, this is definite progress, sounds like. It sounds like forward motion. And for the naysayers who say that, like, you know, nothing ever changes, like, this is exactly what we need to start seeing progress being made and change coming, positive change. So yay.
Yeah, for sure.
I love it. This is really cool.
Yep. Yep. I think it's really positive, especially the CBD part. The Election Assistance Commission work is also really important because, like, even just by putting together a survey, asking questions about security gets people thinking about security.
Yeah.
So I do think that, you know, any kind of expertise that our listeners who tend to skew pretty nerdy in these areas could provide would be great. Again, those links should be in the show notes. If you get this through, iTunes or, you know, whatever normal podcatcher of your choice, click through those. It's at the first one is at regulations.gov. You can search for it. Second one is at it-isac.org. You can search for that. But they're both pretty near the top of those respective pages.
Cool. Awesome.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So it's all good news in the world today, right?
pretty much. If you're looking for some bad news, though,
we
just released a brand new research report called the ICER for Germany, and that is the Industry Cyber Exposure Report.
ICER. It sounds so cool.
Yes, very good. It's part of the reason why I'm in Germany, and by part, I mean all. We surveyed basically the top 320 companies in Germany. They're everybody that's listed as a prime standard company on the German stock exchange. And we do our normal exposure measurements for them. So this is the fifth in a series. We've covered US, Australia, UK, and Japan, and now Germany. And so we're able to take a look at, like, how is corporate Germany looking? Pretty great when it comes to SMB, not so great when it comes to DMARC. That is the 7-second version of that report.
And how does that compare with the other countries we've looked at then?
The SMB stuff, so like the exposure of SMB and Telnet is vanishingly small in Germany. I think it's the smallest of the five regions. US is still a little bit of a horror show there, but Germany has gotten the message from WannaCry and NotPetya and Mirai, really, a couple years ago. So there's very little exposed Telnet and SMB in Germany. As far as the DMARC configuration, DMARC is a email security apparatus that hooks into your DNS, basically says that mail that comes from a domain is actually sourced from that domain. German companies do not care about this. About 91% of German companies surveyed have either no DMARC policy set to none, or unusually broken DMARC that doesn't actually do anything. So they're in a situation even where, like, they think they have the stuff, but they don't have the stuff. So that's even worse.
Are they using something else to protect themselves against this risk?
I'm sure that they're using components of DKIM and SPF, but DMARC is kind of the name of the game these days. This is like table stakes.
Isn't SPF to protect you from sun damage?
Absolutely not. That is you're looking for sun protection factor. This is sender protection framework, I believe, is what it stands for.
easily confused. Yes. I make that mistake all the time.
So I'm sure they have something, but it's not DMARC. And DMARC is the standard. It's been a standard for several years. You know, there are governments around the world who are really pushing to get this implemented all over the place, and standards bodies and all that. So, like, if you run a mail infrastructure and you're not running DMARC today, you are behind the curve.
So if you're interested in the ICER reports, all of the ones that we've done are on our website in the research section. So you can check out. Once again, those regions are the US, the UK, Australia, Japan, and now Germany. Is that right?
Correct.
See, I was paying attention.
Hey, look at that. We will likely also have, like, a wrap-up report, like, real short, at the end of the year that, like, compares all the regions to each other. I mean, we have all the data, so why not?
Yeah, sure, why not? Well, you know, because it's Christmas and we want to get drunk. Yeah. Okay, so awesome. And so does that leave us with going to our special guest?
Indeed.
Oh, so yeah, time to welcome Rob. So this week, our guest, as I mentioned at the start, is Rob Graham. Rob has a security company called Aratasec, a security consultancy, and is very known both for the blog that he writes on Arata's website, which, if you're not familiar with it, you should check it out. Rob does a great job of sort of going over things that are happening in the security landscape, and he is not shy to share an opinion, which is somebody else who is also not shy to share an opinion. I appreciate that a little bit. It does make some of his blogs quite controversial. You should totally check them out. They're always worth a read. The other things that Rob is super famous for, he's done some pretty cool shit in the past, some pretty important cool shit, like Black Ice, which I think Rob's going to talk to us about a little bit in a minute. And Rob also runs something called MassScan, where he scans the internet, which again is something that Rapid7 likes to do. So we've got loads in common with Rob, and we like him a lot. He has told us that he is not going to troll anybody, but I don't believe him, particularly as he said that this promise was only good on September 31st. We know what we can do with Rob's promises on that one. So we wait to see what happens today. Somehow I think I'm going to get trolled a lot today. I think he and Todd are going to go to town on me. So hi!
No.
Welcome, guys!
Not at all.
So Rob, why don't you tell us a little bit about Black Ice, since I, like, did a stuttery job of mentioning it in the intro. And it's a cool thing.
Yeah, so Black Ice was something I wrote 20 years ago. It was eventually bought out by companies and eventually bought by IBM, who then, that's where products go to die.
Oh, no.
But nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. That's like an actual expression.
It is.
So like IBM's like this weird company. Like it's got this, it's its own huge market, but it's its own market. Like you're either an IBM customer or you're not. So there's like the outside world, and then there's like this inside world that's just IBM. So anyway, Black Ice was the first IPS and was the first in a lot of technologies, which are pretty common these days.
I'm going to assume that people listening to this podcast know what IPS stands for, but just in case...
IPS is an intrusion prevention system. It sits in line, so it detects intrusions like an intrusion detection system, but can also block them. And so we had a desktop version and a network version. And so many people, if you're in cybersecurity 20 years ago, you probably installed it on your desktop. But if you've been in cybersecurity for only the last 15 years, you've never used it.
I have used Black Ice, by the way, right?
Yeah, because you're an oldie.
Correct.
So we did lots of cool things with Black Ice, like user mode network drivers, which for a lot of people, they think, well, for performance, we need to put everything into the kernel. And we did the opposite. We put everything in the user space, including the hardware drivers. And that's how we achieved good performance. And nowadays, that's pretty common. So if you look at a lot of security network security products under the hood, you look at what's happening with like the Linux kernel, but actually all the firewalling and stuff is happening in user space because they're using, it's very standard now to use user mode network hardware drivers.
Do you think it's a bad thing that every time somebody says the kernel, I want to make a Colonel Sanders joke? Do you think that means that my security creds should get revoked? Like I'm not allowed to work in technology because I want to make a Colonel Sanders joke.
I think you definitely get demerits. So watch your step, Ellis.
Are we working on a merits and demerits system?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't anyone tell me? The stress of it. All right. So it's in the kernel, or it's not in the kernel. That's what you said, right? It's not in the kernel.
So it's not in the kernel. And also how to do parsers, how to parse network traffic efficiently. It's kind of a black art that, again, it's common today, but back in the days, it was very difficult for people to know how to parse traffic, how to parse network protocols. It's one of those things of, it's like, there's a certain way of doing protocol parsing to be safe and fast. And then like some people know it and most people don't. So it's not in textbooks and stuff. And so, but it's a known thing, but it's yet most people don't know it.
It's kind of like this like InfoSec oral tradition, right?
Right.
Like you don't get it in your network programming class, but you do get it in like your intro to security class.
And even then people don't do a good enough job on it.
Well, right.
So why did you call it Black Ice?
Well, you know, when you write software, there's often a code name. So I lifted the code name from William Gibson's Neuromancer book because that was I stood for Intrusion Countermeasure Electronics. That was sort of what we were building. So one of them is called Black Ice. That was the type that would fry your brain because
it will kill you.
In his book, everything has a direct, you know, physical wired copper connection so they could send voltage back to fry your brain. Of course, in reality, like right after the book was written, everything switched to fiber optics. And so that's no longer possible. But anyway, that was a temporary code name for the product that we just decided, well, we'll just make it the product name. And I always felt kind of bad about it. And because, you know, you're just lifting a name from a book, right? So you're not giving credit to the author and stuff. So a few years ago, William Gibson tweeted about how people lift names from product names from his books all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about like Wintermute. Someone had created a product called Wintermute. And that was the baddie in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, and people lift names from his books all the time, but they're never successful. And then someone tweeted back about Black Ice, how it was, you know, wildly successful back in the day. So then I tweeted back saying I felt kind of guilty about this. And that I lifted the name, but, you know, never did anything. And William Gibson came back and said, well, yeah, if you just buy me a new MacBook, we'll call it good. So I bought a new MacBook.
Oh, my God. I love that. That's so great.
A MacBook Air with, you know, all the highest end I could get at the time with, like, you know, all the goodies. I never get the
all the goodies.
The protection plan of stuff. And so I got that. And so it's like the most I spent on a laptop, I think, forever, because more than for myself.
Is this the story of how you and William Gibson became besties?
Yeah, so he sent me like a satchel, the Buzz Rixon satchel, because he had this Buzz Rixon products in his books that don't exist. So then Buzz Rixon made the products, and so he sent me one of them. And so, yeah,
that's pretty cool.
That's kind of amazing.
His last book has got me accredited in there for providing computer services.
Oh my god, I love that. That's so great.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm sure he's a really big listener of Security Nation.
Well, I'm sure he will be now.
He's listening to this whole thing and he's like, oh, Rob, the times we've had, me and that laptop. It's amazing. Okay, well, next time that you and he are having like a, you know, a sleepover and you're braiding each other's hair, let us know. Totally sounds like fun. Cool. All right. I was going to ask other questions, but like, I feel like you've kind of, you've basically, like, can we just talk about that a bit more? Like, do we need other stuff?
Yeah. Speaking of people who write books, I hear you're writing a book.
Oh, right. This is why we have Todd. He's a professional. I just want to talk about braiding people's hair. Okay. So yeah, you're totally writing a book. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I'm writing a book on securing network code.
Not the next great American novel.
It's not the great next American novel, no. But I'm kind of doing it out of spite, because that's really my motivation for most things in life.
Right. Yeah.
Because everyone's doing it wrong, and so I wanted to show how it can be done right. And a lot of things on how to secure like IoT devices and stuff focus on more of the hygiene approach of like body odor. And like, you know, we're all offended by body odor, but you know, health is not hygiene. You know, health is specific things about, you know, like exercising and eating less sugar, and not about like whether you take a shower every day. You know, your neighbors care about if you take a shower every day, but that's not really health. And so we have this idea for like IoT devices and other stuff that focus on hygiene, which is sort of just like waving your hands over the problem about how to secure these devices. Like the recent thing that Zatco is doing with showing how all the IoT devices don't have ASLR enabled. And that would certainly help things and stuff, but that's sort of like hand waving. Like, where do these security problems begin? So ASLR helps you, like, when you have a security problem that, you know, it's less likely to be exploitable. So that's a hygiene sort of thing. But where do the security problems begin with? And how do we refactor the code to get rid of them? Recently, XM is a popular email server, which I think your guys' scan was like 57% of the internet.
Yeah.
Of publicly accessible email servers run XM. And so XM is a prime example of no amount of ASLR and stuff in the back and no amount of hygiene will fix the problem, because they've got fundamental core problems they haven't solved. What XM does is they pass all their strings through this generic scripting system, which can have just replaceable variables. I can say, like, put username here, then the default username gets replaced in the string. Or it's actually a full scripting language where you can call function calls and DLLs. It's really nasty. And they pass everything through it. So they pass things like the host name they get from the SNI field and an SSL certificate through this system. So it's not simply a host name. You can supply actually a full script as the host name that you're connecting to. And that's really, really, really bad. And it's a common problem that you have throughout the internet on all these projects, that people don't define what the input is supposed to be. Like, this is just a host name. It should only be a host name. They sort of like say, well, I'll accept anything that's in this field coming from the cell connection. And whatever it is, I'll apply no sanity checking, whatever. I'll just pass it on through the rest of the system and someone else can handle it.
Well, there's a lot of assumptions there, right? Like, I mean, yeah, I'm expecting a host name, so probably 63 characters or so. So it'll be fine.
So whatever, it'll be fine. And if somebody needs something else, they probably want it for a good reason. And And this is the internet from 20 years ago or 30 years ago, this robustness principle of being very lenient on what you receive. And what that means now, and XM's a great example, is that input is Turing complete. Turing complete is this notion that something is a not simply data, but a full programming language. So a host name is a full programming language. That's now an XM spec, basically. It was never defined by this. That just by the lack of doing any validation on this field means it's a full programming language. And therefore, you could hack XM, but with just by providing more than just a host name. And so that's something, again, that's not taught about parsing. There's this LangSec group of academics who focus on this, but pretty much nobody else that says that, you know, input is a language effectively, and it controls back-end computation, and you should probably know what computation it controls. In XM's case, they didn't. They just said, hey, we'll just take this input, pass it on through the system. As a programmer, I have no idea what happens after this point, so I won't worry about it. But from a hacker's point of view, they can control input and control computation and hack the system. So anyway, it's pragmatic things like this. How do we identify these problems in existing code, and how do we refactor them and get rid of these problems?
Well, and how to avoid them in the future too, right? Because like this particular XM bug was introduced like, you know, three trivial versions ago. It didn't exist before then. And presumably it's been squashed and it'll never come back, right?
Right.
But that's the problem.
Right. I think that's super interesting. I think that, you know, to your point, I think a lot of people are not thinking of themselves as developers and yet are developing things.
Right.
And so this problem that you said, where they're like using this language and not understanding necessarily what the implications could be, that seems like something we might see more of somehow. Yeah, cool. So what made you, you did it out of spite, but like, what made you actually get off your spite seat and think, I will actually invest time and effort into this? And like, what's your plan with it? Where do you want to go with it? Like, is this something that people are going to use as a textbook for university courses, or like, what's the deal?
For two things, one of which would be useful for university courses. I know a number of professors, they don't have a textbook on teaching students on how to secure the code. I mean, there's a few resources, but they tend to be hygiene focused rather than, I've got this problem here, this causes numerous, you know, here's CVEs working backwards. If you didn't have this, you wouldn't have the CVE. So there's not really a good textbook like that. And so I'd like there to be one. And second of all, I'd like there to be something I can point to, saying, well, yeah, I go to a company and consult and say, well, here's a textbook you can read on how to fix your problems, so that I don't have to tell you, you know, verbally.
So what you're telling me is that instead of talking to your clients, you're going to point them to a textbook you've written. Brilliant.
I'll still charge them the same amount, of course, but yeah.
Well, presumably, yes. You'll charge them the royalties for the book. buy this book from Amazon and you will have the answers to the questions.
So there needs to be a text I can point to saying, you know, here's all the stuff that's kind of wrong or superficial and doesn't really help you much. Here's something that will, that's right. So it'll give me more opportunity to say what's wrong by being able to point to something that's right.
So is it purely focused on issues that are developer side? So it's all about secure by design.
It's developer side, yeah.
Okay.
Though it comes up into like your things, like policy and stuff, because there's a lot of policy that's not based upon technical resources. They're sort of saying, well, this sounds good from a policy point of view. I want it for the work. And well, there ought to be more texts and more data around, but whether that's actually a good policy or not.
When you say policy, you mean public policy, not security policy.
Right. Public policy. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that there is a lot of conversation in policy circles at the moment around secure by design and how we can, incentivize the right behaviors, and so I think you're right that, you know, having better information on what that looks like is helpful for policymakers, and having people like you to participate in those conversations and help educate those people, I think is positive. So cool. So how long have you been doing this?
For 6 months, it's pretty much I do my walking in the evening for exercise and think about things and come back and add it to the text.
Nice. So this is your evenings that you're writing away. And how far through do you think you are?
I've probably written more words than will be in the book, and then I keep paring things down to be more focused on the topic because I want to ramble on, like, this is all important stuff, but, you know, is it really focused on the topic? Well, I don't think so. So, yeah, I've already got, you know, the notes file of, like, you know, this is really important stuff, but how important is it to the text?
So you're going to basically provide teaching aids as well for the university courses. I can see it becoming a whole franchise. It's going to be a whole thing.
Yeah, well, there's a bunch of code I've written, too, and parts of it are up on GitHub already, of demonstration of, like, okay, here's, like, XM is wrong, and here's what you would do with XM to make it right.
So you're going to have merchandising and everything. It's going to be amazing. All right. This is really cool. So do you have a timeline in mind?
No, because I'm really bad at such things, and it'll probably meander around for a year. It's like Mathgan or Sidejacking or Black Ice. It's like, when I started actually getting serious about it, it'd already been like a year or two into dabbling.
I think a lot of people can relate to that. But I think, like, that's one of the big things, isn't it, about taking on new projects, is how do you motivate yourself? How have you been motivating yourself?
I have no idea.
Is it just when you get angry about stuff? Is that what it is?
You know, spite is a great motivator.
It really is.
Being able to say, like, this is wrong and here's right. Like when I write blog posts, and most of them are out of spite. Like this recent Crown Sterling thing of, they say they cracked a 256-bit RSA key in 50 seconds. So, well, I know how factoring works. And so I, out of spite, is pretty much download the factoring software and do my own factoring of the keys. And it takes about 50 seconds. I mean, it's the same. That's pretty much what they did, as far as anyone can tell, is they just did what everyone else does, and that they get the same results. So the fact that, how long does factoring an RSA 256-bit RSA key take? You know, that's knowledge that, you know, out of spite that these guys are idiots, someone actually needs to do the test and then write it up.
You're so living the life that Todd wants to be able to live.
I don't know.
No comment.
I mean, I'll argue about the OSI model just as much as the next guy, but I don't know if I'm motivated enough to write a book about it.
Oh, yeah. I'm in the airport. Yeah, I've got like a 3-hour layover or something like that. So I just go this long tweet stream of what's wrong with the OSI model. Again, out of spite. It's like, it's all wrong. It's always been wrong. And the teachers who teach to you know what's wrong. And that's the thing about it.
That's the crazy part.
No one knows what the session layer does, and but they continue teaching it as if they do know, as if it's a thing, because it's not a thing. And so all the students end up not knowing what the session layer is and feeling like something's wrong with them.
Right.
Like, if only I were a better student, I would actually grasp the session.
Right. I would understand this dogma that has been handed to me.
What? Right. That sounds totally bona fide to me. Mm-hmm. Work harder, students.
And the reality is the professor didn't know what it was. They're just regurgitating what was in their textbook, and the textbook writer didn't know what it is, and they're just regurgitating what was in something they read.
So why are they doing that then? Why does it continue to perpetuate? Why do we not find better ways of doing it if that is the case?
Because that's the standard, and how dare you, like, disagree with what the standard is? Is the government standard?
Oh, it's dogma then.
Yeah, it's dogma.
So you're not allowed to go against dogma.
It's also, OSI is super easy to teach, and it's easy to test on.
Yeah, it's like, what's layer 6 of the OSI model?
Right.
Or layer 5, sorry. See, I'm already getting it wrong.
Back to school for you.
What is layer 5? I don't know. Like, session, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Yeah, it's layer 5 session, layer 6 is presentation, layer 7 is
demo. Yeah.
So there is no session or presentation layer in any network. It never existed, and it never will exist, and it's something that's still in the model. Because they created the model before they created the network that are hoping it would exist.
Right.
So aside from, like, finding motivation and finding time, have you sort of run into any challenges since you've been writing your masterpiece?
The thing is, again, focus is, I want to write about so much. Like, this is a great topic, but I start writing things that are off topic. Like, this is really interesting, cool stuff, but, you know, does it really help you solve this topic right here, right now?
Right.
So I write too much.
How do you force yourself to have self-discipline around that?
I don't know. I'm just sort of spiraling in toward the center. It's just sort of like it's not discipline so much as just ruthless editing at the end.
Okay. I mean, TCP/IP Illustrated is 3 volumes, so there is that.
And each of those volumes is next to your bed.
No, just the one.
No, it's all wrong. So I don't like.
I've already
it.
Burned that book.
TCP/IP Illustrated, it was already dogma back in the 1990s, and it continued to perpetuate bad. You know, it's not just session layer; it's all sorts of things, like how do you do byte ordering? That was wrong. And so one of the epiphanies of many programmers when they remember their networking class using TCP/IP Illustrated was, oh my god, integers. We have a 2-byte integer. The bytes can be in either order on the network, either left to right or right to left, or big endian or little endian. That's a big epiphany for them. That's what they remember from their networking class. But how it was taught was wrong. So TCP/IP Illustrated is wrong.
Oh.
So there.
Hot take. TCP/IP Illustrated. Take that, Addison.
So like, what have you learned through the process of writing this masterpiece, Rob?
I've learned I appreciate all textbooks because it's a lot of work, and I don't know how they happen because it's really a daunting task. I just thought I'd take some blog posts I've done in the past on these topics and just collect them together and put them together in a book, and it's much more than that.
So I like the sentiment very much. I'm super curious as to how this new sort of enlightened view has like actually worked in progress for you. Like, when was the last time you picked up a textbook and read it and were like, I fundamentally disagree with all of this, it's complete BS? Did you have that moment of being like, no, I'm going to respect the fact that somebody put their time and effort into this? It was a lot of work. But were you just like, this person's an idiot?
Yeah, I don't think I've learned that sort of humility yet.
Baby steps. Okay, cool. So if somebody listening was like, oh my god, I am totally wanting to write a book about this thing. Maybe they're listening to you and they're like, I really super disagree with everything that Rob Graham just said. I'm going to write a textbook that goes against everything he says. What advice would you give them? Maybe I shouldn't ask you to give advice to people who disagree with you.
I would love to see such a thing because you learn when someone disagrees with you, you learn a lot more than when people agree.
I agree with that. Oh, no. Sorry, I disagree.
So I make it very easy for people to disagree with me, like on Twitter and stuff.
Yes. Oh my god, that is so well put. It's like you're doing a service. Mm-hmm. You make it really easy for people to disagree with you, and I appreciate it.
And people do disagree with me, and you know, a lot of times they're wrong, but sometimes I learn and I there are things when I'm wrong, and people tell me that and explain and take the effort to explain to me exactly how wrong I am. And you know, it's kind of rude, I guess, from one perspective, but it's, you learn a lot.
I will say, like, all joking aside, and I do love to tease you, but all joking aside, I will say that I have always found you to be somebody who is very open to listening to different points of view and also to having the actual discussion and explaining your point of view. And for me, with the policy work that I do, you know, we talked about public policy earlier, I have found that to be incredibly valuable and has helped really sort of refine my thinking and shape some of our policy positions. So I'm super grateful for that. Thank you. And as you say, we don't always agree. Sometimes we get closer to agreement through the discussion, and sometimes we won't. We have, you know, slightly different political leanings. But I really appreciate the fact that, you know, both of us are quite opinionated people. cough. But I think both of us are people who appreciate having other people help challenge our assumptions and knowing that we've kind of gone through that process of like, you know, is this the right thing? Do I really think it? Okay, yeah, I've tested it. I really do think it. Or perhaps, oh no, now I've heard that point of view. Actually, that's a great point of view, and I'm going to tweak my thinking. So I appreciate that about you very much. Thank you.
It's also okay that people disagree.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. It's healthy that people disagree.
I can't imagine anything worse than being in a room where everyone agrees with you. I just, that would be the worst thing.
I mean, I always think like a little bit of, if everybody knows the stuff that I know, then what's the point of me?
Right.
The point of me is that I have a British accent and I swear a lot.
Right.
Okay, great. Well, Rob, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about your masterpiece. We look forward to reading it. Todd will understand it. I probably won't. And yeah, if we can do anything to help, let us know. Todd, as ever, thank you for educating me on all the things and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Bree, our amazing producer, thank you for putting up with us and making it all work. Check out next episode, where we're sure to be talking to somebody else who's awesome. And have a great week until then. Thanks.